Hello, my name is Tom Wright, or N.T. Wright, as my publishers like to put on the book, since those are my initials. I am currently a senior research fellow at Wycliffe Hall in Oxford, which is a sort of semi-retirement, semi-job. Before that, I was professor in St. Andrews in Scotland, and before that, I was Bishop of Durham in the Church of England, and that really sums up the sort of stuff I've been doing for the last 50 years, dodging to and fro between pastoral ministry and academic teaching.
N.T. Wright, Tom Wright, great to see you here at the Lanier Library.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Yeah. Now, what's your impression of the place? It's your fourth visit?
It's extraordinary. Every time I come, I think, oh, yeah, I remember it being something like this, but it seems to be even bigger than I'd remembered. And so many of the features, the architecture and the woodwork and so on, are just lovely. And, I mean, I know why they are as they are, because Mark told me that he went looking around the Oxford libraries and said, mm-hmm. I want like this and like this. And so that gladdens my heart. That's my world.
Yeah. It looks a little bit like Oxford when you show up.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It's rather like if you go to Yale University particularly, if you're from Oxford, you get a shock because there is Magdalen Tower. What's that doing here? And the answer is they built it to look like that because that was the kind of gold standard. And so Mark, in a sense, has done the same thing.
He's done the same thing here. Well, your friend and my colleague, Mike Bird, calls it Disneyland for scholars. So it's we have bunnies hopping around and swans and all those kind of things as you walk around. So that's fun as well. So you're here to do a lecture entitled The Romans Road Through the Dark Valley. It's your fourth lecture here, and I think 2014 was your first time or somewhere in there. But we're so glad that you're back. We've been hoping this event could occur, but COVID kept interfering.
Yeah.
We're sort of back, and we're so happy with that. You told us a little bit about you as in your academic sort of life, but for those who want to peer behind the curtain a little bit, who is Tom Wright?
Well, I grew up in the north of England, quite close to the Scottish border. My family had been there on both sides, mother's and father's families, for two or three generations. And that's where I think of as home, really, the far north of England.
Mm. It's kind of mountainous and hilly there, right?
It's hilly.
It's not mountainous.
It's not yet really mountainous, but poised between the hills on the one hand and the sea on the other, which is very nice. And when I was living in St. Andrews in Scotland, that's very similar. You're in that bit of Scotland between the North Sea and the hills inland. So I feel as I'm kind of formed by that landscape in a way. It's a nice wild landscape, plenty to explore. I come from, on my mother's side, a family full of clergy and school teachers, and on my father's side, a family most of small businessmen. And that's an interesting combination. I think I've probably got a bit of both of those in my makeup.
Yeah.
Family has been very important to me. I was very fortunate looking back now in the stable and secure home that I had with three siblings and all sorts of things going. Not much money, but a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And
of course, when you're a child, you don't realize that you're not totally wealthy, right? I mean, you just don't realize where you are.
This is how things are. This is what we're having for supper tonight. And you don't sort of...
You think everybody lives that way.
That's right. So when I was a teenager and somebody said, how do you like to eat your steak? I don't think I'd ever eaten proper steak before. It just wasn't an option. Anyway, family is still enormously important to me. As you know, David, my wife is Maggie. We've been married for nearly 51 years now.
Wow.
And we have four children all in their 40s, and we have six grandchildren from a 17-year-old down to an 18-month-year-old. So they keep us busy.
Yes.
And actually, I thought retirement was going to mean slightly slowing down, and it really hasn't.
It hasn't slowed down yet.
Because any academic slowing down has been more than made up for by childcare duties and doing the school run on occasion and that sort of thing, because some of the family live very close to us.
Well, your grandchildren will tell stories one day about how formative you've been.
That may be. That may be. It's a little worrying. what will they remember?
What will they see?
quite.
So you're going to be lecturing here on the Romans Road through the Dark Valley. And it's fascinating. I've had a chance to read through and scan through it, I'd have to say, what you're going to be doing. And a lot of it has to do with Romans 8.
Yeah.
But first of all, what is the Romans Road for those who don't know it?
I suspect that most listeners to your podcast may know what they mean by the Romans Road. It's not a phrase I grew up with, but I've heard it a lot in my adult life as an easy phrase used by people who do evangelistic work and apologetics and personal pastoral work, often one-on-one, where if somebody is inquiring about the Christian faith, at a certain point, a certain style of evangelist or apologist will open Paul's letter to the Romans and say, okay, we're now going to travel the Romans Road. Mm. And the way that's normally done is to look at Romans chapters 1, 2, and 3, but particularly the middle bit of 3, where Paul says, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Mm. Now, this comes as a shock to most ordinary, sensible Western people. You mean I'm a sinner? What is that about? Trying to convince somebody that they are a sinner would be step one. Then step two would be explaining to them that Jesus died for their sins. Step three would be explaining that if they believe that Jesus died for their sins, and if they confess their sins and believe that, then they will, quote, go to heaven, unquote. Mm. Now, ironically and sadly perhaps, Romans doesn't mention going to heaven. It mentions salvation, but we have assumed that the word salvation means going to heaven, which isn't what Paul or the New Testament says. That's the big shock, of course, with a lot of this, because Western Christianity has assumed that the name of the game is how do we get upstairs to God, whereas in fact the Bible is telling the story of how God comes to dwell with us. That's long story, very short, but that's where it is. But then with the normal reading of the Romans Road, Abraham in Romans chapter 4 becomes just an example of somebody who believed and was justified. Mm-hmm. And then chapters 5 to 8 become a kind of extended treatment on the Christian life. Introduction in 5, baptism in chapter 6, and then the puzzle about who is this person in Romans 7 who doesn't know whether they can do what they want to do, etc. And then Romans 8, it all comes out into the sunlight and the Spirit is within us and nothing shall separate us from the love of God. Fine, except we've just skipped over a few bits en route, and some of those bits are really very dark and very perplexing. Mm. Not only Romans 7, but also Romans 8, where Paul says, provided we suffer with him, that we may be glorified with him, with Christ, that is. Mm. And his exposition of the groaning of all creation in chapter 8, verses 18 and following, and of the groaning of the church within that, and then of the groaning of the Holy Spirit within that, within us. Mm. Well, I have never heard an exposition of the Romans Road which even tries to deal with that. Now, of course, there may be people who have, but I think the normal way it's been lined up has not dealt with that. And from an early age, for some reason, I'm not quite sure why, I've always had this sense that when you have a text which somebody is quoting, it does sort of matter that you go and see what the whole passage is about.
Yes.
And chase through that. Yeah. So that's what I'm trying to do.
So this dark valley is really the state of where we are today, I suppose, the state of humanity, state of the world, the way things are.
Yeah.
Not as they're supposed to be.
Well, quite. And I think we've conned ourselves in my lifetime, particularly after the end of the old Cold War, in other words, since the late 1980s, I suppose, when it looked as though, well, okay, communism's finished, it's had its day, the old countries of Europe are all going to become nice Western-style democracies, etc. And yeah, there's still some other troubles in the Middle East or the Far East or in Africa, but we can sort of deal with that. And I sense that the cultural mood has been one of complacency, which then soaks into the church as well, that really there aren't any huge global problems, except maybe some people are hungry somewhere or whatever, but somebody will deal with that in due course. And I think we've trivialized the extent to which actually the world is still very much groaning in travail. And two things have brought that so much back to our remembrance, quite apart from personal things which may have happened to us, which shock us and cause us to grieve deeply. The pandemic, the last 2 years, we didn't see that coming, and we weren't ready for it. We didn't know what to do about it. We still, in a sense, don't know what we should have done or could have done.
But it'll take us 20 years to figure out.
If then.
how we could have done it
quite,
better at
quite.
That point.
And people will be writing PhDs about it and so on. But then, and I don't know how you in America are reading this at the moment, but certainly we in Britain, a shock to the core by the war in Ukraine. We didn't see that coming. When Putin was assembling his troops, he was saying it's just an exercise, and we were saying, yeah, it's just saber-rattling. And then suddenly, you know, the guns start firing. And it hasn't worked out the way anyone thought, for good and ill. And people are saying, what does this actually mean now? Are we going back to another Cold War? Or is it going to be World War III? And how, as Christians, should we be thinking about that? And then I come back and I read Romans 8 and I say, the whole creation is still groaning in travail, seems to me. And Maggie and I have a friend who is a Ukrainian university teacher, and she and her children are refugees in Poland at the moment. And we get a bulletin every two or three days from her about what she's seeing and hearing. And it's,
well, you
it's,
think about
it's the, pretty horrible
the damage
stuff.
That is happening to so many millions of souls that forever changed by this.
It has, absolutely. And, of course, the irony is that Putin thought he was just going to bring Ukraine back into part of Russia. He has united Ukraine against him. I mean, even if he manages to flatten a third of the country, which it looks as though he's trying to do, I don't think Ukrainians will ever, ever, ever consent to being part of Russia, except at the point of the gun. Which is,
I think,
of course,
that did
what
shock us, didn't it? When that happened.
So I mean, these things have sharpened up for me something which I've thought about quite a lot. In fact, the first time I did something really serious on Romans 8:18 following was during the first Gulf War, when I had to do a Bible exposition to the Church of England General Synod, which is a rather strange body to speak to, not a middle-aged clergy and others who all think that they know what's what. And the Gulf War had just begun, and I was asked to do an exposition, and I took this passage and talked about the groaning of creation. And I have a sense of coming full circle 20 years later. Is it 20 years? More than that now.
Since I would think so.
Early 90s, yes. Yeah,
that's
okay.
30 years.
30, it is, yes. Okay, I'm getting old.
Wow.
And in a sense, apart from the book of Revelation, this is one of the very few passages in the New Testament which really makes us think, ah, this is the map where we live. This is where we are right now.
And I think it's early Galatians, where Paul talks about we have been rescued out of the present evil age. And I think very few people take that seriously, that statement that the present evil age continues to exist. And it continues alongside the work of the kingdom and the work of the church.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Paul is there channeling the Jewish idea of the present age and the age to come. And the present age is the evil age, and the age to come will be the time when God puts everything right. And, of course, the extraordinary thing of the gospel is that God hasn't waited for the present evil age finally to stop before inaugurating the new age. And so we live in this uncomfortable overlap. And I think Romans 8 is very much about the uncomfortable overlap. So there's a huge amount of glory and delight and comfort and excitement in Romans 8. But you get that in the context of the suffering which the church is called to share in as well.
You know, we've got to talk about Romans 8:28 just for a moment.
If you wish.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's one you've been puzzling over for a while. It's an amazing passage. Sometimes I see it crocheted on pillows. Or put on the walls of a house or something like that. And it's a very common saying, and a lot of people leave out part of it. They just, well, everything's going to turn out okay,
kind of
idea.
But
that's not exactly what this passage is saying, right?
I was talking to a group of pastors in Oxford just a couple of weeks ago, and somebody asked a question which led to this question. And I looked around, there may be 150 people there, and I said, you all know Romans 8:28, right? And they all sort of nodded, and I just said, go on then. And they recite without looking up. They mostly recited it in the old King James Version or something like it.
Which is what
all things work together for good for those who love God.
Right.
And the idea of all things working together actually has a kind of a stoic ring, that almost a pantheistic ring, that just stuff happens, and if you love God, then it'll fall out on the right side for you. And that's how many people have read. Now, in a sense, I don't want to say that's totally wrong, because I know a lot of devout Christians have actually leaned heavily on that verse when all things have gone horribly wrong in their lives, and they've just had to cling on to something. I think God doesn't wait for us to get all the exegetical I's and T's dotted and crossed before he can speak to us. Thank God that that's, otherwise we'd all be in trouble. But the key word is the verb, which is synergi. Toisakaposintontheon panta synergi. And synergi means with work. Ergi is the work bit. Sun is the with bit. Mm-hmm. And it takes a dative, and the dative in this verse is toisakaposintontheon. In other words, what it means is we know that God works with those who love him, which is... That's been off limits for many people for the last 400 years because of the specter of something called synergism. It's the same word, working with, as applied to salvation, as though, well, God does part of the work of salvation, but you then have to do the other part. But the point is, Paul isn't talking about a doctrine of salvation here as such. He's talking about what God does in the world and how God recruits believers, those who are in Christ, to be his partners in that work. You can see this in, say, 1 Corinthians 3, where he talks about we are God's fellow workers, sun ergoi, same word, or in 2 Corinthians 6, 1, when he says, so working together with him, synergunteste auto. And what I think is going on there is that it's picking up from the previous two verses where he's talking about the task of prayer, the strange prayer where we don't know what to pray for, but the Spirit is working within us.
And is interceding for us.
The Spirit is interceding, but the Spirit, as he says earlier in the passage, the Spirit and our spirit are kind of linking arms and doing this together, and God the Father, the one who searches the hearts, knows what is the mind of the Spirit. Paul sums up that extraordinary picture as, that's what it means to be a God lover. But people in whose hearts that is going on, this is what it looks like when people are within the love of God and loving God in return. And then he says that God is working with and through these puzzled human beings to bring about his good purposes. I find that extraordinarily encouraging. It's one of the things that's missing from so much Pauline exegesis, so much theology, is a biblical appreciation of the vocation of human beings. And Psalm 8, that God puts all things under the human feet and crowns us with glory and honor. And I think, you and I have at least one friend who wouldn't agree with this, but we'll sort that out, that glory here has to do particularly with the status of authority and dignity given to human beings in the gospel, following from Jesus, the human one, who was the ultimate Psalm 8 prototype, if
yes,
you like.
Yes, yeah. Well, it continues, that passage continues about the fact that he, those he foreknew, then he predestined to be conformed to the image. So that image to me, that's really the work of salvation in this world, right? Conformed to the image of the Son?
Yeah. It's the image there obviously refers back to Genesis 1:26, et cetera, where you get, here is creation with the image of God in the middle of it. And now we are to be like that, which is the genuine human thing, as in Colossians 1. And now we are to share that.
Yeah.
And so I read that whole passage now quite differently from how I did, say, when I wrote my commentary on Romans, which is 20 years ago, 20 years and some, when I was still looking at it, as we have all been taught to do, in terms of a doctrine of, a 16th century doctrine of election, with glorification, meaning finally going to heaven. But actually, doesn't mean going to heaven. It means becoming the genuine humans we're meant to be. Now, at the same time, this is why it's such a rich and dense passage. Of course, the revelation of glory for which the Jewish people were waiting was that God himself would come back in glory and reveal himself to Israel and the world. And Paul is channeling that story as well, which is why what he says about the Spirit is so important, that simultaneously, this is the long-awaited Isaiah 40 moment, the revelation of the glory of God, and the long-awaited Psalm 8 moment of human beings discovering what it means to be set in a strange, dark authority over the world.
To truly be the true humans, what humans were meant to be from the beginning.
Absolutely. And this sounds as though it's trespassing on the Eastern Orthodox doctrine of theosis. And in a sense it is, but because if you believe in the Holy Spirit, you have to believe that. But the whole point of this passage, or what part of the whole point, is that doesn't mean you become less human. You know, the idea that humanity and divinity are a zero-sum game, and the more you have of the one, the less you have of the other, that is one of the enormous lies that has dogged our footsteps throughout the history of theology, really.
Mark talks about the fact that that's sort of a shortcut we play. It's either this or that without trying to think about the both and the and.
Of course. It's got to be a both and. And the doctrine of the image is central to that, that God makes humans in his own image because he wants to come and be a character in his own story by becoming human.
Yeah.
That's absolutely crucial.
This is going to be a great lecture. We're looking forward to it.
Oh, so am I. Thank you very much.
I'm excited about that. Now, we'll put in our show notes for those who would like to know more and who want to see it. It's not yet happened, but when it happens, it'll be recorded and it'll be put up on the internet.
Good. Thank you.
Great to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Nice to be here. Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks to Janet Seifert and Kathy Capes for helping us produce this podcast. Jocelyn Solis is responsible for promoting the Stone Chapel podcast on all of our social media. Thanks to Phil Keggy for our music. These podcasts are made possible by the generosity of Mark and Becky Lanier and the Lanier Foundation. If you have questions or comments or just want to be in touch, email us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. That's podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Lanier is L-A-N-I-E-R. Thanks for listening.